Board, which operates Odeo Charter School and the Charter School of San Diego. I'm Mary Bixby, founder, president, and CEO, and I will facilitate this meeting. Let's take the roll first. When I call your name, please provide the group a brief introduction, which you already did, for the benefit of our new members and members of the public. Admiral Lynn Herring is excused. Scott Barton?
Present.
Scott Barton is a member of the board. And David Crean, you're here.
Present, member of the board.
Member of the board. Tim Morton is excused. He attended the workshop on Monday. And Eric, where are you, Eric?
Present.
And member of the board. Do I have a motion for approval of 1.3? This is the establishment of a quorum. So I guess I need a motion for that.
Motion to approve.
And a second?
A second.
And we'll vote. Scott Barton?
Aye.
David Crean?
Aye.
Eric?
Aye.
Okay, very good. Motion passes. Can we stand for Pledge of Allegiance, please? I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you. Item 1.5, approval of our agenda. Do I have a motion for approval of item 1.5?
So moved.
And a second?
Second.
Okay, any discussion? None heard. We will conduct voting via roll call. Scott?
Aye.
David? Aye. Okay.
I'm sorry. I was on mute.
I read your lips. Eric?
Aye.
Okay. Motion passes. Moving on. Public comment. Public comment for items of interest to the public and within the scope of Student Success Programs Board, non-agenda items, shall be no longer than 2 minutes. Public comment for agenda items shall be no longer than 3 minutes. Speakers may not yield their time. In accordance with the Brown Act, no discussion or action may occur at this time, but it is the board's prerogative to respond or give direction to staff. All public comment will be heard at this point in the agenda as ordered below. Each agenda item being commented on will have a maximum of 20 minutes allotted, and each non-agenda item will have a maximum of 10 minutes allotted. If necessary, the board chair may decrease the time for each speaker in order to stay within the allotted maximum. Item 2.1, non-agenda public comment. This is an opportunity for members of the public to speak to the board on items not on the agenda. Speakers will be limited to 2 minutes per speaker, and this item is limited to 20 minutes, unless otherwise modified by the chairperson. Speakers may not yield their time. Are there any public comments on items not on the agenda? None heard. This is an opportunity for members of the public to speak to the board on items that appear on the agenda. This is item 2.2. Speakers will be limited to 3 minutes per speaker, and this item is limited to 20 minutes unless otherwise modified by the chairperson. Speakers may not yield their time. Are there any public comments on agenda items? I heard, moving on. Item 3.0. Young Mini and Core Law Firm will provide training to the board regarding the Brown Act, Conflict of Interest Law, Public Records Act, Government Code Section 1090, compliance with SB 126 and the Governor's Executive Order N29-20, N15-21. Thank you. Paul?
I'll take it away. Mary, I wonder what we would have thought 30 years ago if somebody had said we were going to be doing a Pledge of Allegiance to a virtual flag and giving presentations online entirely. As things have changed.
I have no idea.
I realize this is a mandatory presentation, so I will try to make this as painless as possible. Let me figure out how to share my screen here with Teams. I'm accustomed to doing this with Zoom, but not with Teams.
Looking your upper right next to the leave button.
Yeah, I'm just trying to not share the particular screen that I have open. I will try this and tell me if you're getting the. Okay, there we go. All right, we're good. Thanks, guys. Appreciate the time today. As Mary said, I've been at this for almost 30 years now. So again, I think I can try to be concise and try to get this down. We're going to be talking about three primary laws: Brown Act, which is the state's open meeting law. Then we're going to talk about the conflicts of interest laws and the Public Records Act laws. Those three laws make up the primary transparency laws that apply to all public agencies in the state of California and effectively to charter schools as well, because effective January 1, 2020, the state of California clarified that charter schools in any form, fashion or another, operating as nonprofits like, have to comply with the Public Records Act, the Brown Act, and the conflict of interest laws, which come in different shapes and sizes, including the Political Reform Act, Government Code, et cetera. There were a number of changes in the law about where boards must meet. And I'll quickly go through these because actually there are three sections and each one of your schools has a slightly different application, whether it's, each one of your corporations, whether it's Miris, SSP, or Adeo. If you are a governing body of one non-classroom-based school that does not have a facility, operates only in one resource center, and has everything in one county, then you must meet in that county. You have to have two-way teleconference locations be established at each resource center. So for, we've got student success programs. I'll go on to the next one because it's, you've got a governing body of an entity managing one or more charter schools located in the same county. Everybody in the same county, that's student success programs. Obviously, we've got SSP, you can meet in San Diego County. You still have to have two-way communications or teleconference locations at each one of your school sites, which I can tell you're doing. It looks like someone's participating from one of your resource centers today. And then if you're a charter school or a nonprofit that has multiple charter schools, like Adeo, and you operate in more than one county, you have to do three things. You have to hold your meetings in the county where the greatest number of your kiddos reside. You have to do the two-way teleconference locations, and you have to video record or audio record or both your meetings and post them on your website. So you have slightly different arrangements. Miris, I know, has one school, two counties. So you got to meet in San Bernardino County, assuming that most of the kids reside in San Bernardino County, even though you have a facility in Riverside County. And you have to do two-way telecommunications. SSP, meet in San Diego County, two-way telecommunications at each one of the resource centers. And for Adeo, again, assuming that most of the kiddos reside inside San Diego County, then you would meet in San Diego County, have to do two-way telecommunications, but also have to audio and or video record and post those to your website. Purpose of the Brown Act. So it's to foster broad public access. And there's a quote in the Brown Act that talks about the fact that the people of the state of California don't yield their sovereignty to the agencies that serve them. And that's the main perspective, is that your public board members, officers of the charter school, et cetera, are public servants doing a public good with public money and delivering a public service, and that the public should have broad access to what's going on. The Brown Act, which is the state's open meeting law, applies to when you have a meeting of the board. Well, when do you have a meeting of the board? You have a meeting of the board anytime you have a congregation of a majority of the members of the body to coming together. And we'll talk about whether it's physically together or virtually together, like we are here, to hear, discuss, deliberate, or take action on any item of business that's the charter school business. So two parts, majority of your members talking about school business. Act applies to virtually every single one of the committees of a charter school. So you have your main board, your nonprofit board, but if you had multiple committees, it would apply to nearly all of those committees, except for an advisory committee that's composed of less than a majority of your members, and that is not a standing committee. Example might be, should you decide that you want to study and make changes to your health and welfare benefits, you could appoint, as a five-member board, you could appoint two of your members to go out and, you know, meet with health care companies and provide a recommendation back to the board. That'd be advisory. It would be not standing, and it would be less than a quorum. And that body wouldn't have to comply with the state's open meeting laws. So as we've talked, we're going to talk about, a meeting requires an agenda and requires sticking to the agenda. The thing that is prohibited under the Brown Act, and is the big issue, the topic of discussion up and down the state of California for school districts, counties, and for charter schools alike, is serial meetings. And you have a serial meeting anytime you have a majority of board members engaging in a series of communications outside a scheduled or agendized board meeting through direct communications or intermediaries or telecommunications, and you're talking about an item of school-related business. So the idea behind the Brown Act is that the deliberative process of decision-making is made publicly. Serial meetings take that away. So if you're spending time, if you're on a conference call and you don't have an agendized meeting and you've got four out of your five members talking about an item of business and you're going through the deliberative process, you're having a serial meeting. Serial meetings happen in a couple of different ways, but primarily they happen in what's called a hub or a chain. You've got this scenario where you've got communications. One board member calls two and says, hey, I got this item of business. I really like this. Want you to vote for it. Two calls three and says, one called me and I want to vote for this too. How do you feel? The minute you hit three members out of five, you had a majority talking about school business, even though it wasn't happening all at once. This happens more quickly with emails. Someone emails the board as a whole, and all of a sudden somebody replies. Now we've got five board members emailing back and forth on something that's within the scope of their business, and we have a serial meeting. And worse yet, we've got documentation of a serial meeting where you're having this deliberative process occurring outside a regular scheduled meeting. It can happen with text messages, social media, website postings, online forums, and telephone calls. These are all areas where if you're using those mechanisms to communicate with a majority or more of the board members, you have a serial meeting. Fax machines, if anybody still uses those too. It feels weird to even have a fax machine on our website, our email addresses anymore, because I don't think we've received a fax in a long time. Serial meetings, however, don't prevent anybody from having one-way communications with your organization. So your executive director, or your chief financial officer, and other administrators can push communications up to your board. And hopefully, typically, that information will go up to the board. Maybe it's agenda item packet, something for the board's consideration. We'll say one-way communication, please do not reply all. And that's fine, as long as, again, the executive officer sort of in the middle is not communicating the position of other members to the board as a whole. Now, thankfully, through technology, boards now can meet in video, audio, telephony. So a lot of board members started meeting years ago, just obviously having conference calls. Then we got into video, and there are some additional requirements if you want to meet via video. So you have to post your agenda in all teleconference locations. So if somebody, one of you was going to participate in a meeting you were actually holding at your main facility, but someone was going to be in a hotel in New York, technically, in order to hold that meeting and that person to participate on their computer virtually through Zoom or Teams, they would have to post that agenda at that location. And the agenda would have to say, David is in a five-star hotel. No, you can drop a five-star code. A hotel in New York, and is, you know, you actually have to make your room accessible should anybody actually want to come and attend the meeting coming into your room. You have to, each teleconference location would have to be accessible, which means, by the way, you can't have a board member participating in their car while they're driving down the freeway. because we can't post an agenda on the side of the car and people can't participate while you're in your car. All votes have to be taken by roll call vote. Each teleconference location has to be ADA accessible. Depending on what kind of car you drive, that might be a problem too. And members of the public have to be able to hear and have to be able to communicate with each other from that location. So there has to be some form of speakerphone, et cetera. And a quorum of the members have to participate within the jurisdiction. So you couldn't have 3 out of 5 of your board members back east and 2 in San Diego County for SSB. So Assembly Bill AB 361 would continue flexibility that the governor's executive orders gave to school districts, counties, all state agencies in the state to be able to meet virtually during the pandemic. And the I think 2 things happened. One is people appreciated the flexibility for safety's sake. They also appreciated the logistics of being able to attend a meeting from your home. And the members of the public, frankly, some members of the public liked it. They were able to get greater access to some of their boards because they were able to witness it online. They were able to comment online. They were able to provide feedback virtually. So not surprisingly, the assembly passed this bill, proposed and passed this bill that gives some flexibility to agencies to continue to use the virtual environment for meeting, assuming certain conditions have been met. And I'll talk to you those in a second. Under this bill, you don't have to post an agenda at every location. Every location doesn't need to be listed. So in the example I gave, David's Hotel would not need to have the posting there. It would not have to list that. A quorum of the board members don't need to be located in the jurisdiction of where the school has to meet. And you can participate from areas that weren't publicly accessible, like a car. You can continue to hold these meetings virtually as long as you meet these conditions, as long as there's a proclaimed state of emergency, which is declared by the governor and which we still have, and one of the 2 following conditions have met. State and local officials have imposed or recommended and promoting social distancing, which technically doesn't exist anymore. They're pushing vaccines, obviously, instead of the social distancing. Some counties may still recommend social distancing, but this latter provision is the one we're really relying upon, which says the charter school board determines that meeting in person would represent a risk to the health and safety of attendees, board members, staff, et cetera. And so what you see is that board members and schools up and down the state, for the most part, are still taking advantage of the flexibility of this law by passing a resolution, which we'll talk about on the next slide, that meets certain conditions. If you do meet these conditions, which you still do, you still have to protect the statutory right of people to be able to appear, give testimony, post your agenda, you know, not require people to submit comments in advance. And if there's any technical disruption of your meeting, you have to stop the meeting until you can sort of get back online and get things reset. So this allows members of the public to witness and participate virtually as long as you're still holding your meetings virtually. In order to do this, though, going forward, we have to, the organizations, each organization, every month, unfortunately, every 30 days, has to either pass a motion or adopt a resolution that said the charter schools reconsidered the circumstances of the state emergency, made a declaration there is still a state of emergency, and had one of the 2 following conditions apply. The state of emergency continues to directly impact the ability to meet safely, or again, state and local officials continue to oppose recommended social distancing. So as long as these 2 conditions are met, you can continue to meet virtually, which a lot of our clients are taking advantage of. Now, I will note that it does say every 30 days. So if your board doesn't meet every 30 days, some districts are being rather picayune about this and are saying you have to call a special meeting to have to essentially pass this resolution in order to have your next meeting that might be after 30 days virtually. That seems extraordinarily picayune, but
Paul, that's something. Paul, I have a question on that.
Sure.
This is David speaking. Can you do a unanimous written consent, a UWC on that?
I wish you could. And as a nonprofit, you can, but as a public agency, you can't.
Okay.
So yeah,
we have to put this on the agenda for every time, and we may need to have a quick call as a board to make this motion and put it into the minutes.
Right. That's exactly it. And you can still meet virtually to do this. So that's right. The advantage, obviously. It would be a short meeting, but you still have to get it done. And again, I hate pushing people to do something that seems like you would have to. You could wait till the 40th day, but school districts have been on us about this.
Yeah, so. But I guess what I hear is, and perhaps we can be proactive, maybe Angela can just get something on our calendar every month.
Yep. Yeah. And if somebody emails, I can send you the language for the motion or the resolution, however you prefer to do it.
Thank you.
Paul, may I comment on that? Because I work with Kimberly. So what we have been doing since the adoption of AB 361, we have been putting it under the roll call. We the chairman of the board or whoever is presiding the meeting, we announce the findings as long as we do it before the action item and every board meeting to be safe, and that suffice. And I work with Kimberly on this, so we have the findings. The board has not adopted a resolution, but rather the findings, and you do it before the board action, any board action, and you're covered for that meeting.
Yeah, as long as there's a motion or it's included right. Or rolled up in something else, yeah, you're doing good. We just want to be able to point to something in your minutes where your board, the language is considered. That's the key thing, is that you consider, is there a state of emergency? Is there still a health and safety issue? So that's great, Lynn. So anytime you have a meeting, you have to have an agenda. And we try to add a little levity to this, but for an agenda, it has to be, you know, posted in advance of the meeting. I'll talk about it, typically 72 or 24 hours. It has to include a brief description of the items to be transacted. The idea here is that you're giving the public an idea, do I want to attend and participate? And with few exceptions, the item is not on the agenda, you can't talk about it. So the notice requirements are usually brief description, less than 20 words. What I usually recommend, frankly, is that you look at what your granting agency is doing and try to model your agendas somewhat after your granting agencies. Some can be overly descriptive. You don't necessarily need to be overly descriptive, but you do need to essentially let people know what the board is going to be considering. You have to have, if you have to be able to provide disability-related accommodations, hearing impaired, et cetera. So there should be a phone number on your agendas, which I believe you do, that allows people to call in or email in to get accommodations to be able to participate in the meetings. And the location for the inspection of documents that must be made public when documents are presented to the board or majority of the board has to be located as well. So people can say, all right, I want to come down and look at the board binder. Clients mostly will usually email or post a copy of the board packet as well.
May I ask you, Paul, how long do you keep all those board minutes and notes and all that stuff?
Great question, Maria. I think it's probably going to depend. And you hate lawyers, right? That's all they get. I swear you went to 3 years of law school to learn how to say it depends. But it might depend because we have a board policy that dictates or recommends, I should say, holding periods, 10, 7, 5, 3, and 1, typically years, for certain records. So it may differ. If the agenda and the materials included something related to facility purchase, it might be longer. If it was related to or had items related to personnel decisions, it might be 4 years. Contracts, 3 to 4 years. So it might depend generally, but the materials themselves, not to get into too much of the details here, but if you've got the agendas, typically they may remain on your website for a long, long period of time. Same thing with the minutes. The backup materials, again, I think is something that you can talk about on a case-by-case basis. It's funny, I'm looking down in the bottom right-hand corner. It may look like I'm looking down, but Mary's actually down in the corner of my screen here. So you've got three notice requirements. Regular meetings, you post 72 hours in advance. Special meetings, 24 hours in advance. And I hate even putting up here the emergency meeting 1 hour notice because the requirements for meeting an emergency meeting are so high. In 28 plus years of doing this, I've never actually seen them met. And it's essentially terrorist threat, or you've had a 7.0 earthquake and you have to meet to be able to decide what to do in the next hour or so. Most always we're recommending don't ever even consider that. Just do 24 hours if you can. post and going to the meetings. It's rare day that you would have a 1 hour meeting. Posting at your public accessible location within the jurisdiction, so all at your resource centers and at your main offices and on the website homepage in a prominent location with a direct link is specifically a requirement under the law. All right, so the whole thing is all of this about access and about the rights of the public. So what are the rights of the public? They have the right to give oral testimony at this meeting. You heard tonight, you know, Mary, you've got it set up properly. You're allowed to give testimony on items that are on the agenda and items that are not on the agenda. Although for special meetings, that can technically be different. You can drop the off agenda item comments if you want to. They have the right to give oral testimony at the meeting. You can set time limits. You can address disruptive speakers. You cannot, however, tell people to stop speaking. They can speak at their peril, but you cannot tell them to stop speaking. Now, the video went away for some reason. I'm assuming you're still there. You still there, Mary?
Yeah, she's there.
Oh, okay. Some reason the video in the bottom right-hand corner of my screen went away, so I don't see anybody.
Yeah, she's still there.
Thanks, appreciate it. Virtual meetings, you know, everybody's learning how to control virtual meetings and stay in control and not allow people to take over, as they call Zoom bombing and the like. A lot of people drafted policies around that. People are allowed to audio record and to rebroadcast of your meeting. There cannot be any limitations on the conditions of public attendance. You can't require people to sign in. The facilities have to be non-discriminatory, ADA compliant, and copies of the agenda and other public writings presented to the board have to be available to the board members, have to be available to the public, as well as the time that they're made available to the board. Now, you are allowed to go into closed session or executive session. And I don't know how many people can actually go back long enough to recognize the picture of Get Smart and their I forgot what exactly the cone of silence, I think, which they spoke in, but that's the humor here, is you do get to go into closed session outside the public's eyes for limited circumstances, to talk to your lawyer because of attorney-client privilege, to talk about pending or active litigation, to talk about personnel, the appointment, employment, evaluation, discipline, dismissal of employees in closed session because of the privacy implications. However, if you are hearing complaints or charges against an employee in closed session, this is one of those caveats. You must give the employee 24 hours written notice of the right to hear those complaints or charges in public hearing, in a public meeting. If you don't do that and you take negative action against that employee in closed session, they can actually have that decision overturned at a later point in time. So it's always a good idea to talk to your lawyers before you go into closed session on personnel matters, especially if you're talking about negative evaluations that border on complaints or charges, or discipline that borders on complaints and charges. You can talk to your real estate negotiator in closed session. You can talk to your labor negotiator if you have unions, which you do not at the moment. You can go into closed session to talk about public security issues. So we have gone into closed session to talk about COVID concerns, COVID protocols and policies and the rolling out of things like that. And people wanted to talk about the mandatory vaccine mandates and things like that. And you can go into closed session to effectuate pupil discipline. It's a closed session. You have language in the agenda that has to be included. And there's specific language in the Brown Act called safe harbor language. If you use to describe your agenda items for closed session, you're going to be protected. Prior to closed session, you have to report out the reason you're going into closed session, which typically means nothing more than reading the closed session agenda item description. Public has to have an opportunity to comment on closed session, even though they won't know exactly what's going to be discussed. But I suppose if you're going into closed session to discuss personnel and it says, hiring of the chief business officer or something like that, obviously they may want to comment on that. And after closed session, you have to report out action taken in closed session, and you have to report the vote or abstention of every member. So if you took action and if it was anything other than unanimous, you'd have to report out the vote or abstention of each member. And only necessary personnel can attend. So there's no such thing as a semi-closed session. You have to be closed session with your board and your chief administrators that are only necessary to effectuate the item. And as a reminder, and I'm sure you know, confidentiality around closed session is an absolute must. It's something that is outlined in the law. You can be personally liable for violating it. You can be personally liable for violating it too if you violate someone's privacy rights, because as board members, you are privy to very sensitive student information, personnel information, and the like. Now, some of you may remember the city of Bell and the fiasco the city of Bell caused for a lot of public agencies. As a result, the law was changed to say, anytime you are setting your main administrator's compensation, here, CEO or executive director's compensation, has to be in a regular meeting, so 72 hours notice, not a special meeting. And prior to taking any action, you have to report out the recommendation. You have to have a salary schedule. You have to talk about the benefits and a comp study. And the all action has to be taken on salary in open session. So what happens if you violate the Brown Act that we've talked about here today? Typically, the first thing that happens is you're going to get a notice of concern brought by your authorizer, because they're going to ask you occasionally, are they going to go to your website, and they're going to look at your agendas, and they're going to look at your minutes, and they're going to compare the two. And if they see you talking about things in your minutes that weren't on the agenda, or they see things that aren't thoroughly described in your agenda, or closed session that's not allowed under the law, they're going to issue a notice of concern, which is the first step towards a notice of revocation. So you want to quickly respond to that. Typically, you want to talk about counsel, how to respond. Others can issue, anybody who sees a violation of the Brown Act can demand a cease and essentially a cure and or cease and desist. And they can be brought by a DA or the member of the public, and you've got 30 days in which to respond. Actions taken in violation of the Brown Act can be overturned. So if you enter into a contract and it wasn't properly agendized, and you know you were 6 months into the contract, that contract could be set aside. And you may have to take action to reinitiate that contract. Before I move on to conflict of interest laws, if there were any questions about the Brown Act, I'm happy to take a moment to stop here.
No, I don't have a question. I just a comment. I'm glad that these various acts have evolved and have incorporated, virtual format. So it's very promising to see that inclusion.
There's enormous cost savings. For example, this training alone typically would have been in person, which I miss the in-person, obviously. But there's flight time, there's flights, costs of travel, that sort of thing. So people are able to participate and save money as well. So I think that's terrific for the organizations. So
years ago, we had what we called retreats, where we had board members that joined us in a very informal basis to discuss strategic planning and issues that related to the future development of the school and, where we thought we might go and just considering the environment, all kinds of different things. As I understand it, those can still happen, but they're more like a board meeting, and the informality of it really doesn't or can't exist. Is that correct?
Anytime you bring that majority of the members of the board together to hear, to discuss or deliberate on an action, or even not even to take action, just to hear items within the scope of their business, then yeah, it'd have to be an agendized meeting. You can do it virtually, of course, like we're doing here, but that's why you have to agendize board workshops like this even. All right, I figured out a way to see the videos now, so I'm good here. All right, so conflicts of interest. This is one where a lot of schools have gotten into trouble. Now, I will say it's just one of those areas where they've gotten in trouble because they're not paying attention. You guys receive annual training. I know you're very good about your Form 700s, et cetera, so you're sensitive to these issues. But you'll understand why as I go through these. But, the broad definition of conflict of interest is any time when the individual's private financial interests are, conflict with their own interests of the organization. And so here, you know, you have a conflict where there's that clash between the individual's interests and the individual's fiduciary responsibilities to the board, and that person is participating in or influencing or attempting to influence a contract or other decisions. So it doesn't just cover contracts, as we'll talk about. Types of financial interests that are regulated by conflicts of interest laws are any ownership and investment in a business entity, investment in real property, sources of income, and gifts and effects on personal finances. So what you normally want to do is think to yourself, and as you'll see in a later slide, what are the universe of business entities I'm involved with on or own real property, income from a source, or if I get gifts from somebody other than family and friends, or I have income, personal financial income coming from it, that are in the area in which the schools over which I oversee do business. So if you own a home in Hawaii, not a big deal unless the school takes retreats in Hawaii. If you own a home in Tahoe, again, not a big deal. But if you own a, you know, waste management company in San Diego County, or your spouse works for an IT company in San Diego County, those are things to, all right, start to, you know, like, these are things I need to pay attention to. And it involves the financial interests of your immediate family as well. So dependent children, spouses, et cetera. There's two primary conflict of interest laws we're going to talk about today. First is Government Code 1090. It's the most draconian. It's the one we want to absolutely under all circumstances avoid. The second is called the Political Reform Act and is equally bad, but you'll see in a moment why the penalties aren't as bad. But the Government Code 1090 violation occurs when you have a public officer, which is either your board or an employee, who is participating in making a contract, who is a public official and has a financial interest in that contract. It's related to contracts only. So if there's a contract coming before your organization, and I can give you a recent example in Northern California, one of the board members was part of a venture capital company that has ownership stakes in education companies, LearnZillion, things like that. Those contracts came before the board. That's a public official possibly participating in a contract in which that person has a financial interest. Board member has a financial interest, the entire board cannot vote on the contract. Doesn't make a difference if it's the best deal possible, best price, et cetera. It's an absolute prohibition, and making that public contract is broadly defined. So you can't even have the early conversation about consideration of it, planning, solicitation of it. You have to stay away from it. It's the toughest standard to meet, and a violation of 1090 is a felony and voids the contract. And if you're a public official, could actually get you kicked out of office, as our former superintendent of public instruction, Bill Honig, knows, because he was the former state superintendent of public instruction, got involved in a curriculum, I think it was a curriculum contract for the state board in which his wife worked. So that was another example of where Government Code 1090 comes into play. Now, that's a felony. Political Reform Act applies in the same sort of thing. Public official participating or attempting to influence a governmental decision, but doesn't have to just be a contract. Could be a decision whether or not to put up light standards, for example, on your high school, on a field next to a property you own. And you have a qualifying interest in that, and the financial interest is material. Under this law, it allows you to disclose and recuse yourself from the decision-making process. So there are a lot of detailed regulations about this. Like I said, examples I can think of are where board members on the board wants to lease a facility to the school over which he or she is on the board. Or I had another Northern California example, which was the one I just gave, where one of the board members' houses was within 50 feet of the school that they were putting outdoor lighting up. And these are the sorts of decisions that created a conflict of interest in which that person was allowed to disclose and recuse. And these are enforced by the FPPC, which is the Fair Political Practices Commission, not typically by the DA like Government Code 1090. That's why it's a little less, it's still a problem. We want to avoid it. There can be fines and penalties, as I'll talk about in a minute, but it usually won't end up in jail if you violate Political Reform Act. Now, each organization who is subject to these laws has to have a conflict of interest code. The conflict of interest code defines The people in your organization who have to make what they call annual Form 700 filings, statements of economic interest, and it defines what level of the disclosures are required under those statements of economic interest. Now, as I recall here, this slide has a bunch of lines. There we go. Statements of economic interest are filed anytime you join a board. They're filed once annually on around April 1st, or anytime you leave an organization. So say you filed one in April, 60 days later you left, you have to file another one within 30 days of leaving. If you fail to file, there are criminal charges, not typical. Typically it's a $200 fine for not filing in sufficient time. The financial interest on the Form 700 involve the things we were talking about before, but there are financial thresholds involved. So it's investment of the business entity of $2,000 or more. It's real property of $2,000 or more, which is any real property, let's face it. Income of $500 or more, or business position. So this includes non-compensated officerships or board members of other organizations in the area, or organizations or people for which you receive a gift of $50 or more. Now, the form, the front page of the form looks like this, if those of you who've already filled it out. Typically includes all your financial interests. However, doesn't include your residence. It doesn't include income from a public agency. It typically also doesn't include, I don't have to summarize, if you have a public retirement account, you don't have to summarize all the stocks or equity ownership of CalSTRS. So a lot of people who only own a house, only have salary from a public agency, and only have essentially CalSTRS or CalPERS retirement, can fill out this form and check one or two boxes on the front page and you're done. It takes you literally 5 minutes. If you're fortunate enough, you or your spouse or your dependent children are more affluent and have property or business holdings or stocks in the area, or stocks of businesses that are in the area, those things have to be filled out with a little greater detail and it takes a little more time, but it really, once you've done it once, it's actually pretty straightforward. Gifts, it usually doesn't come up in the chargeable concept, but you're not supposed to accept gifts in total in any one calendar year, $500 or more, or you have to report anything that's $50 or more. However, there's a lot of howevers. It's special occasions and gifts from people that you normally exchange gifts from is not a problem. Inheriting money, obviously not a problem. Family members, spouses, gifts among them, BFFs, etc. As long as it's a long-term friend, or the people that you're in a bona fide relationship with, those are all fine. If you ever do get a gift and it exceeds $50, you don't want to report it, you can donate it. You can donate, if it was a $200 gift, you could donate, $151 of it and not report the $49 and things like that. But those are, the gift giving and reporting is not something that comes up a lot. Hopefully in the charter school world. Now there's a couple other conflict of interest laws here I want to talk about briefly. There's the prohibition against conflicts. It's a common law conflict of interest. This is one that when they say common law, it's not one in statute, it's one in court cases. And they essentially have developed court cases that say, if there's an appearance of impropriety, even if it's not financial, it could be a conflict of interest. So I'll give you another example. You're a board member whose child attends the school. You wouldn't want to be involved in the decision whether or not to fire, for example, or discipline your child's teacher. People are going to say, can that person really be totally impartial in that decision? If it's mid-year, and obviously maybe your child likes the teacher. So anytime you think there's something outside the school sphere that would push you in a direction other than what's in the best interest of the organization, that could be a common law conflict of interest. And then we have doctrines of incompatible offices. You can't hold two public offices simultaneously. And unfortunately, we have a real example right now. Just recently, the Attorney General issued an opinion where one of our clients' executive directors of a charter school serves as a county board member in a county in which that charter school is located. And the Attorney General concluded that that was incompatible office. Now, Attorney General opinions are only controlling against the state, and we'll have to see what happens in the long run. But again, you typically wouldn't serve on a charter school board if you were on a school district board, a county board, a planning commission, a city board, any other local agency board in which, one or more of your schools might be located. Now, before I turn to the last section, Public Records Act, on these slides, any questions about conflicts of interest? Hearing none, let's turn quickly to the Public Records Act. So the last law in the sort of the triumphant, the three-prong law, or the three legs of this chair about transparency laws is the Public Records Act. And the Public Records Act is a broad, broad law that says, for the most part, almost all records of your public agency are going to be public records, subject to the Public Records Act, which is a state of provision of laws that allow any person to ask for access to, review, or copy, or receive copies of, in original format, records. Records are broadly defined, as you'll see here in a second. It includes emails and text messages, and it includes emails and text messages of board members and administrators on their private devices, even if they're related to school business. That was a California Supreme Court decision about 2 years ago where they said you can't hide public agency documents in private emails or private text messages. And so someone can come along, just be aware, and ask for that. So typically we recommend, and I know you do this, that you use the domain of the organization in which you're a board member for all communications, because then we don't have to worry about, if you ever got asked for records on your private account, you would just say, I don't use my private account, my Gmail, Yahoo account for school-related business. I only use the domain, and that'd be done with that. Electronic records are covered by this, and unfortunately right now we're seeing more and more requests for emails. And so Mary and Lynn, I think, can attest to this as well. Having a record retention policy that defines the term of how long you're going to keep emails is critical, because people can ask for and receive these massive requests of emails that go back years and years, and we have to produce them. And it can be extraordinarily costly to go through them, because we have to redact them first. We have to go through and make sure there's no personnel information, student record information, or confidential information in there. And so it's very expensive. If you get a records request, it can be oral, it can be written, it can be email. You have to respond in 10 days. Now, some people think if someone comes in and asks for records orally that you don't have to respond, you still do. You have 10 days to give a written response and to let them know generally when you're going to produce the records. You do have the right, if it's paper copies of records that you're producing, to charge a per page copy cost, but that's really going on the wayside right now, because most records are contained electronically and people come in and ask for them electronically, and we cannot charge for the cost of extracting those records from your system. There's one exception to that. If they asked for some data set that was part of a giant data set and you had to hire a programmer to be able to get that data out, you actually could charge that cost of extraction, but it generally doesn't apply to all the other types of extractions that we've seen. But there are exemptions, as I noted, primarily for student records, for personnel records and the like. There's no exemption, unfortunately, for uncomfortable records. I mean, there are records that are included that you just like, oh man, I wish I hadn't said that about somebody, but you still have to produce it. There's one caveat to that. There is an exception for, it's a balancing test. And it's a balancing test essentially says the public's interest in this record is outweighed by the privacy of this record. And it's, we've tried this recently in defense to some massive Public Records Act requests for some schools in Los Angeles. Client was adamant about not producing the records, and we've been in litigation for over a year fighting. Literally, the court will take every record and look at it and decide whether this balancing test is met. So it can be very, very costly. And if somebody sues you under the Public Records Act and they are successful in any degree, so say they ask for 100 records, and you produce 98 of them and they still have to sue you for the last two and you produce the last two, they get to reclaim all their attorney's fees. And as we said, writing is very, very broad. So it includes, you know, handwriting. I love how old this is, you know, photostating, electronic facsimile and other forms of communications. But if it's in writing, electronically or written, it's going to be a public record that we're going to have to produce. So you can see that's can be an incredibly cumbersome provision of law these days. Your organization is so large, been in business for so long, and has so many records that people can really, and they do, they tend to take advantage of the ability to ask for records, and they ask for lots of records, and it can be incredibly costly to have to produce all those records. But there is not much we can do with that law right now. So how's that? That was like 48 minutes.
Thank you.
Very thorough. Yeah, I just wanted to point out, Paul, that vendors can ask for public records.
Yep.
If they're trying to sell something and they want to know where you get what, and how much of it you get and how much you charge, they can actually ask for records.
There was a company over the last couple of years that was doing that exact thing, and then they were trying to sell that information to other vendors. They're saying, we've got this giant database of contracts, of charter school contracts, you want to see them? And so they were repackaging it to try to sell it. So it's smart people taking advantage of what the law allows. It wasn't intended for that, but okay.
Right. That's very, very good. Thank you very much. What a great, succinct presentation. Last, any questions for Mr. Manny? Good job. I think you get an A. Look at you.
I got a little clap. I didn't know you could do that. I got a little virtual clap. Thank you, Ronnie. Yeah. Thank you, Haley.
You got two.
Yeah.
Good for three. Okay, you're good.
All right, well, there you go. All right, you guys.
You can't even do, and you got a thumbs up, and I may send you a heart in a minute. That's good.
All right. Well, thanks, you guys. I hope everybody has a great rest of the day and have a great Thanksgiving.
Thank you. Same to you.
Thank you. You too.
All right, don't leave me here, though.
Okay.
Board members, do I have a motion to adjourn this meeting?
A motion to adjourn.
And second?
I second.
Second. Okay, we'll conduct a voting roll call. Scott?
Aye.
David?
Aye, and have a good weekend.
Thank you. And Eric?
Aye.
All right, this meeting is adjourned. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving, and thank you for the generosity of your time. It means
Happy
it.
Thanksgiving.
Take care, you guys.
Bye-bye. Thanks again, Paul.